Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Those long crimson gowns and the winged white bonnets are unmistakable. The iconic uniform from The Handmaid's Tale has become a symbol of women's oppression. It's been worn by protesters around the world, from Northern Ireland to Argentina. In America, activists in Washington donned the same costume to watch the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court justice accused of past sexual assault. And this year, in Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, and elsewhere, the red and white clad campaigners marched for abortion rights. Although Margaret Atwood's novel, The Handmaid's Tale, was published in 1985, its intimidating predictions strike many today as prescient of fresh infringements to women's autonomy. A hit television series starring Elizabeth Moss saw the story claimed as a feminist fight back. The Canadian author returns with a new novel called The Testaments. Nearly 35 years after The Handmaids were born, how has the age of Trump and ongoing climate threat influenced her writing? I'm Anne McElvoy, and today we're asking, how do politics shape storytelling? Margaret Atwood, welcome to The Economist Asks.
Hello. You've resisted writing a sequel for many years, over three decades. You're drawn back with The Testaments, set 15 years after the action in The Handmaid's Tale. I wondered whether you felt you could really let rip with this again now that it'd been on screen and had another incarnation. So much
well,
has happened.
Well, yes, because I started writing it before the first season premiered. And I, of course, had read all the scripts. So what we did try to avoid as time rolled on, and so did my book, I didn't want to be writing anything that was like a novelization of the series, but I also didn't want to be in flat contradiction to it. But luckily, we did avoid both of those things.
And that involves a fair amount of sort of knitting.
It involves some knitting. But it also involves the fact that I was in fairly close communication with the showrunner and could say, don't kill that person, and hands off that baby, by the way, like that. So that was all fine because it was all in accordance with, I wasn't contradicting anything he really wanted to do.
I was thinking about the mood around your writing and how it's received and how it's changed since I interviewed you a good few years ago. Oryx and Craig had just come out. And one thing that really strikes me as different is that, particularly that Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments, is sort of into a mood that describes your writing as prophetic. And I wonder how pleasurable that is, or whether
it brings its own burdens.
It's
actually not true. I'm not a prophet. I don't have any particular insight into the future. If I did have, I would have cornered the stock market long ago. So it would be like one of those Back to the Future movies in which he goes to the future and becomes a millionaire, or learns what will cause him to become a millionaire, like those time loops. It's just reading, actually I have to say, reading a lot of the news, dare I say, magazine and newspaper pieces, and in the past cutting them out and putting them in a box, which I don't necessarily cut them out anymore, but I may print them out. I collect stuff that I find of interest, and I did it for Oryx and Craig as well, because I don't want to be in the position of people saying this is total rubbish and it would never happen. So I like to be able to say either it has happened or they're working on it now.
Hence your attachment to the idea of speculative fiction.
Hence my attachment, but also hence my pickiness due to having grown up amongst the scientists, in which you're not allowed to say something is true unless you can produce evidence to that effect.
And perhaps also your aversion to using the science fiction.
Well, science fiction is a very flexible term. So let's think of it as a broad banner that says wonder tales, and under that you can have various categories, one of them being werewolves and vampires and zombies, one of them being other kinds of horror stories, one of them being books about the future which need not be set on other planets, and one of them being speculative fiction, which is descended from Jules Verne, who liked to write about things that he felt were about to happen or were in progress, as distinct from H.G. Wells, who wrote about Martians with tentacles coming to Earth in large canisters, at which point Jules Verne said, "Mais, il invente," but he makes things up. Guess what?
Yeah, rule so nothing out.
I'm not good at that kind of sci-fi, and it's not that I don't read it, because I do read it, and it's not that I don't like it, because I do like it. I'm just not good at it. And I'm not good at fantasy with dragons either, so I don't write that either, but I still vote for best dragon in show, and it's still Ursula K. Le Guin in the Earthsea trilogy, later to be followed by more books on
good
that
tip
subject.
There.
Yes,
you.
Best dragons.
Thank you. We haven't had that on the Economist.
Most loquacious and wise dragons, as opposed to simply greedy dragons such as the Hobbit, or simply bazookas such as Game of Thrones.
Let's talk about a different kind of fear and reaction to it, and the way that your book, The Handmaid's Tale, particularly turned into a sense of a symbol of resistance, and a lot of that audience is, I'm sure, waiting avidly to open up the Testaments. To an extent, you kind of almost ended up as the beneficiary of a Trump bump.
You're not the first person to have said so, but
what did you do to the last one?
What
did you do to the last one?
The last person, I agreed with them. You know, I'm a fair-minded person. It's true, but I may be the only person on the planet who is such a beneficiary.
And you really feel that the mood around Donald Trump, the resistance to Donald Trump,
I think the fear inspired by the fact that he's packing the courts and looking at certain states such as Alabama, who are taking this as far as they can. And the goal is to overturn Roe versus Wade and make a state claim upon women's bodies as being state property. And if I were any kind of an individualist, such as the state's claims to be full of, I would be deeply offended by that.
To what extent, and when people say, well, I'm reading your book because I'm outraged about Donald Trump, or...
Yeah, they don't tend to say that.
They don't?
No.
What do they say?
They just say, I'm reading your book. Or they say, thank you for your book, or they say, this is really too close to reality.
But do you think of yourself as inspiring a response, as in a sort of action response,
okay,
or
so
as a sort of something that you
enrich? Am I doing agitprop? Is that what you're asking?
You answer it.
No, agitprop would have a plan of what to do. So if it were real agitprop, it would be like that, so agitation propaganda. No, I simply consider that I'm exploring the territory, or if you like, making a blueprint with the question attached, is this the house you wish to live in? Yes or no? And if you don't want to live in this house, make another blueprint of a house you do want to live in.
Let's look at the longer span of time from The Handmaid's Tale and what was going on at the time. You were writing in West Berlin.
Yes. So several things were going on. Number one, the Berlin Wall had not yet come down, and nobody thought it would anytime soon, except Richard Kapuscinski, who did think it would. Guess what? He was right. So there we were in West Berlin, and we were encircled by this wall, and every Sunday the East German Air Force flew by and made sonic booms just to remind us that they were there. And at that time I visited East Germany and Czechoslovakia and Poland, where the moods were quite different in each place, but they were all Iron Curtain countries. Before that, we had just by accident been in Afghanistan 6 weeks before Daoud was assassinated, kicking off the train of events that we have been living with ever since, and followed by Iran, where the Shah was still in power and was to remain so for a mere 8 months. Did coming events cast their shadows before? Not in my mind, though my father said, don't go to Afghanistan, there's going to be a war there. And I don't know how he knew that. But he was well up on the subject through Alexander the Great, who said, Afghanistan is very easy to march into, but very hard to march out of, and everyone who has tried it has found that. So we were just going around the world on the way to the Adelaide Festival, as one does. And therefore, I saw those societies right before they various things came tumbling down, similarly with East Germany, but also World War II, the people that I knew after World War II, because I'm old enough to know people who really were in the resistances, most noteworthily in France and Poland. I knew some of those people, and Holland as well, which had a very well-organized resistance. Life in the resistance, who got shot, who managed to escape, who collaborated, and who, oddly enough, appeared to be collaborating but was actually feeding information to the resistance, and there were a number of those. In a totalitarian regime, if you're not appearing to collaborate, you're going to be dead pretty soon. And I'm just reading about one of your own absolute dictators, namely Henry VIII, in his later years, and the life of Thomas Cromwell, the Aunt Lydia of his time, who was actively furthering the schemes of Henry while secretly holding some pretty Protestant religious views. So make of that what you wish, but all of these regimes have such people because human beings are what they are and we're quite capable of putting up camouflage exteriors to disguise our real aims and behavior. We live in such unpredictable times that you'd have to be an idiot to try to predict definitively the outcomes of some of the chaos and strangeness that we see developing around us. But I am hopeful about human nature to the extent that I think you can keep some of the people down some of the time and most of the people down most of the time, but you can't keep all of the people down all of the time.
And do you think that, regardless of the greater sophistication of manipulation?
I'm worried about that. It was a lot easier to forge passports in the 1940s. What can we say? It was a lot easier to change your identity then. You could do it if you had the tools. You could create a whole new identity for yourself, but you would have to hack into records and get rid of some of the ones that are there, the ones pertaining to you.
It must be very irritating to try and have labels put on your fiction or to be asked kind of why you do what you do, because you write, because you...
Because I must. Because I'm driven. What can I say?
That was definitely the correct answer.
Yes, that's the right answer, yes.
I don't think that's a perfect term. My sort of irksome question was, is the way that you view your fiction is looking at a world that we can't envisage yet in some ways?
Well, unfortunately, I think we can envisage it all too well. If you want people to fall into the big hole in the road that you know is up there around the corner, you don't tell them anything about it.
What are you thinking of there?
Well, if you're heading towards Gilead, if I want you to be in Gilead, I'm not going to tell you anything about it, am I? If I want you not to be in Gilead, I'm going to say, are you sure that this is what you want to do? Because this is where it's going to end up, maybe without the outfits.
And Gilead without the outfits, we were having an interesting debate in my office when we were preparing to come and see
you. Was it about shoes?
No, we were coming onto those. Because we now know that you have a few shoes and clothes weaknesses to share with us. But we were actually having a rather serious, even more serious than shoes, debate, in which someone on my team who said, I really, you know, I kind of read it absolutely viscerally. And I said, well, of course, I read it. Perhaps I'm a bit older. Perhaps I've been, you know, reading your fiction for a long time. I was a bit sort of, you don't like the word dystopia, but that's probably the way that I read it, as I sort of, you know, imagine
don't
if.
Don't go there, yes.
And it was just very interesting to me that you could have two readers, two female readers, as it happened, who just had quite just a different ways of approaching you. She really was practically saying, I'm really worried this could happen.
Yes.
Do you identify more with one of us?
Well, there's more than two kinds of readers. So my usual way of thinking about this is you make the book the best way that you can, and then you heave it into the ocean in a bottle. You don't know who's going to pick it up. You don't know what they're going to think of it. And it is really like a musician playing a musical score. It may be the same score with this musician and that musician, but the interpretations are going to be different. And so it is with reading.
And that's okay.
It has to be okay because that's the way it is. Can I dictate to the readers how they should read the book? I cannot.
Has a reader ever come back with a thought that perturbed or...
Oh, yes.
Talk to you?
They certainly have. So I think my favorite is the man at a Q&A at one of these events who said, well, of course, The Handmaid's Tale is autobiography. And I said, no, it's not. He said, yes, it is. And I said, no, it's not. It's set in the future. He said, that's no excuse.
Hard one to win, that one.
No, it's really, really hard. I mean, it's somebody who thinks they know more about you than you know about
serious.
Yourself.
Yes. Teasing.
Part of what drives the catastrophe and what drives the belief of the sons of Jacob, so the religious extremists that we encounter.
You think they don't exist.
You think I think they don't exist.
They do exist. They may not be called that, but there are a number of paramilitary white supremacists at work in the United States even as we speak.
And that's a good example where I would ask you, did you plot it onto something you'd read about, or do you take
yes.
an idea and then let it grow?
Yes, I did.
And that would be an example you'd find somewhere in your study.
Somewhere in world history, there's the odd military coup. I don't know whether you've noticed that. Yes.
But so many of the problems, the reason that they're able to sort of presumably have moved from the fringes of society into
because
the center
of action. Because there is chaos.
Climate-driven,
environmentally-driven, pollution-driven, all of the things that we are saddled with today, all of these things eventually result in economic and social chaos. Because with climate crisis comes lower crop yields, and with lower crop yields eventually comes food shortage and joblessness and all of those kinds of things that feed into social chaos and angry, resentful French revolutionary types of feelings.
And that, you're a well-known, very seasoned activist on climate change. Do you think you're winning?
Okay, first of all, the real activists are people who do nothing else. I'm just somebody who doesn't happen to have a job, so I can't be fired. So I often get asked to support things, which I do because I can't get fired. The large collective you is making some progress. The Extinction Rebellion people are moving the political needle somewhat because there are a lot of them, and pretty soon they're going to be able to vote. And you'd have to be an idiot as a politician to not recognize that. So even some young Republicans, not old Republicans, but young Republicans are saying, we have to acknowledge this and come up with something.
It sounds like you feel you almost have to go to an extreme to come back to the middle when you talk about Extinction Rebellion.
Well, they're not the extreme. Come on, things could get a lot more extreme than that. But it does tend to be that way. So over here, over there in reaction, and then back to the middle of something that's workable and continuous. So the problem with the bursts of enthusiasm is, can you keep them up?
Let's talk about another great social step forward that's now producing the kind of problems of progress in its wake, and that's the Me Too movement. In some ways, I mean, all these years ago when you were writing The Handmaid's Tale and other essays on feminism and exploring the roots of your own feminism and its changes, you've had quite a long life.
No kidding.
You're still having it, I think.
Yes. She says tactfully. Yes.
Hastily. But was it this the moment, in a way, one of the moments you'd been waiting for?
Not quite, but sort of. So in the general area, but going back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, on which are predicated the Declaration of Women's Rights and the Declaration of Indigenous Rights. So this notion of universal human rights, it comes in after World War II because of what happened to the Jews and other people in World War II. So people get together and they spell out what things ought to happen in a civilized society and who should have what rights. And we've been thinking along those lines ever since. And Universal Declaration of Human Rights, if it's universal, then all humans are human, and that would include women, and it would include indigenous people, and it would include men. So nobody gets to be a non-human person. That's an important concept. It has by no means been implemented in every country in the world. It has by no means been implemented in every sector of every part of society, but it's important to keep it in mind as a principle, or else you're going to have to deal with who doesn't get these things.
Right, so Me Too comes along.
And then you get a fundamental violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is fair process and innocent until proven guilty.
And you feel, just to sort of pull that apart a bit, that is what has happened?
In some cases. But by no means all. It's not harmful to women to say we should respect the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because if you're not going to respect it, women's rights are not going to be respected.
Where does your worry lie? What's the sort of skew here that you think
if you create, which was for a while but isn't anymore, because Me Too has gone through a number of different phases. You're no longer in phase one of Me Too, but there was a moment there when it was an invincible weapon to which there was no counterweapon. And whenever you have an invincible weapon to which there is no counterweapon, some people will take advantage of it, which they did.
And in a way, that seemed to transgress a lot of the lessons that you'd been learning from the Cold War societies, where
not just the Cold War, you know, the history of lynching in the United States. It's the history of any social moral panic in which to be accused is to be guilty. I think we're now in a more reasonable space, and the organizations that I support in this respect are Equality Now and the After Me Too ROSA program. These organizations take a balanced view. So yes,
is this
women...
Also because you knew people you felt were being wrongly treated or wrongly
accused? I read the newspapers.
Not much doubt about that.
So
I wondered if there had been any sort of more personal reasons.
There were a number of cases, and there are also attempts to set them up. So attempts to make false accusations, which the Me Too's and women's organizations would embrace, and then it would all be revealed that it was a sham and they'd be left looking stupid. And there were a number of attempts like that by people who were hostile to women and women's rights. So I think what people learned from that is just do your due diligence as you would as if you were a journalist, and don't create absolutely invincible weapons, and don't assume that any one person in society is not a human being.
There is a bigger cultural question. Is whether pushing things down the legal route, is that, do we need to do more than that, or does that bring you back to your territory where you worry about...
Well, courts can be corrupted, just as any other section of society can be. And I don't know whether you've noticed what's happening, I'm sure you have, is in Russia, where they're using the courts to make these multiple repeated charges against demonstrators in Moscow. And they get time in jail, they walk out of jail, they get arrested again and stuck back in through a court system. So the courts are not necessarily... especially if they're just an arm of the totalitarian arrangement, they're not necessarily any stamp of purity. But if you have a reasonably kind of functioning democracy in which the court system is separate from the executive and there is a body of law, then you've got some hope. But you still have a lot of miscarriages of justice. You have this innocence movement in the United States which deals with people who have been wrongly convicted, and there are a lot of them. It's not the answer to everything.
So you have no qualms, no reservations about standing up for a man you felt was being wrongly accused or convicted?
I don't know whether you're standing up for the person. I think you're standing up for the principle. You may not know the person at all.
The line's not always clear, is it?
Well, people then try to make it about the person, but it should be about the principle. Because if you're not going to support those principles, then you're going to toss out the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and all the things attached to it, and we're just back to might is right. We're completely back to might is right.
You got actually quite a lot of, I suppose, what we now call pushback for some
of
these
comments.
I did
then. That was a couple of years ago.
And you referred to as a bad feminist. What makes... a bad or a good feminist?
No. Which of the 75 different kinds would you like to talk about? Because these views are widely divergent. So I think rather than saying what makes a good or a bad one, you probably have to say what are your interests? What are your particular interests? So I'm not the kind that thinks that all male babies should be killed, except for 10% kept for breeding purposes. I'm not that kind. are you?
That's left quite a bit of wriggle room, though, hasn't it?
Yes, but there are many,
you can see what
many different shades. So I'm
the charge was a certain way that feminists, well, they were supposed to think, right?
Yeah, there was a certain way some feminists had other feminists or other women were supposed to think, and then you're in the age, then you're in the area of Big Brother is watching you, except in this case it was Big Sister. So hew the party line or we will stomp on you with our large boots. At which point, I don't have a job, so fire me. What are you going to do?
Be fired from me.
Trash my reputation.
International League.
Go ahead.
Acceptable feminism.
No, I mean, I'm interested in the kinds of organizations that I have mentioned who are working to improve laws and conditions for women. I'm not interested in the kind that says trans women are not women. I'm not interested in the kind that says let's kill all male babies except for 10%. Not those kinds.
You mentioned Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
Of course, definitive abortion law and establishment in the United States. It's become totemic. Do you seriously believe that it could be overturned?
Oh, yes. Remember what I said about courts? So if you pack the court, if you rearrange the judicial system, I think you could quite easily get some judgments that would overturn it. Is the state allowed to claim possession of people's bodies? Because that's what it is. And there is an instance in which men's bodies are claimed, and that would be the draft. So conscription, the draft, the state claims the right to take men's bodies, stick them in the army, and send them off to war. In that case, the state pays for your food, your lodging, your clothing, your training, your medical expenses. So if they're going to conscript women's bodies, which is what forced childbirth amounts to, they ought to pay for all those things.
It's a slightly odd time to be reflecting on points of the far or even further right in the United States, because a lot of these themes were tied up with the idea of a religious right that was trying to undo.
You think that's not there?
Well, listen to the end of my question and just tell me how you see it. Yet Donald Trump doesn't really come anywhere near those circles.
This is of course not.
But classic religious right argument. It's
no, but Mike Pence does. So the funny mixture is this, and it's very biblically justifiable. So the way they would view Donald Trump is not that he's a righteous man. He's no Samuel the prophet. That he's not. He is what the Bible views as a tool of God. So they would take the view that, no, he's not a righteous person and he's a pussy grabber and all of these kinds of things. Excuse me, am I allowed to say that?
Well, you just did.
I just did.
What are you going to do?
Fire me. We don't care because he's doing what we want. He is God's implement, as Nebuchadnezzar, etc., and Ahasuerus, and what have you, for doing the will of us, which they equate with the will of God.
And you see that as the will of Donald Trump, or a different strain?
Oh, I think Donald Trump is simply an opportunist. I don't think he has any particular religious convictions whatsoever. He's never demonstrated any. He will pay a certain amount of lip service, but it's very minimal.
I can't let you go here in London. You've arrived in a little bit of a constitutional storm.
No kidding.
You might have noticed. We just sent Parliament home, and we're trying to figure out where our unwritten constitution, speaking of your university.
Yeah, maybe better to write things down.
You think we should have a written constitution?
Probably, yeah.
Are you going to come and help
no,
with it?
No, not me. I'm too old. But look back in your own history. It's Cavaliers versus Roundheads all over again with you-know-who playing Charles the First.
And who's you-know-who?
You-know-who.
But our large audience beyond the Lang Hotel in London.
Big girls blouse person. I had to have that explained to me because I didn't know what it was.
This is Boris Johnson.
It's a well-known insult, or was 15 years ago.
An old-fashioned insult. A big girl. What do you make of big girls' blouse?
I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know how to pronounce it. Was it big girls' blouse or big girls' blouse? And why was it a blouse rather than an evening gown or bathing suit or some other article of apparel? I was really quite puzzled, but as a colonial, I often am.
If your queen is your head of state, she...
She would never say big girl's blouse.
I don't think she would
ever say that.
She, of course, had to formally approve the prorogation, suspending of Parliament. Do you think the queen made a good decision?
The queen is a constitutional monarch. She kind of has to do it.
She has to do it. Do you admire the
Queen? Does she come within a panoply? Would one describe the Queen as a feminist?
Well, somebody of my age, dear, remembers the war. The royal family was excellent during the war. They could have gone to the Bahamas, but they didn't. They stuck it out.
So you're sticking with the Queen?
Well, just a minute now.
Oh,
you said, did I admire
here comes
them?
The cover, yeah.
Yeah, of course. They were great during the war. We'll never forget it, people of my age.
You had a fantastic fashion shoot with a newspaper here in Britain.
Yes.
And you were rather marvellously in your pomme, weren't you, with a lot of very foxy, quite cutting-edge designers. Is this the way we're likely to catch you at home?
I think that would be very unlikely. But I got the hair extensions. They're in a bag in my cellar. I just don't quite know how to put them in yet, but I think I might offer it up as a fundraiser at an auction. You know, give my charity of choice lots of money and I'll put the hair extensions in and turn up at your house. How about that? Do you think that would be good?
It might work around Halloween.
Would you pay for that?
I think there's definitely a market for that. Margaret Atwood's hair extensions. Margaret Atwood, thank you very much for joining us today.
And thank you.
From hair extensions to climate change and hashtag me too, we've covered it all. So do let us know what you think. Would you bid for Margaret Atwood's hair extensions or even wear them? Should hashtag me too go beyond the courts? And what makes a bad feminist or even a good one? Write to us, radio@economist.com. Or you can tweet us at Economist Radio. Please do take a moment to rate us on Apple Podcasts. You can read our review of The Testaments. Subscribe at economist.com/radio offer. 12 issues for £12 or $12. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.